Francine Acklin.
Here.
Samantha Bloom. Nicholas Brennan.
Present.
David Brown. Tyler Dixon. Catherine Farrell. Elise Forcier.
Here.
Andy Garcia Ortiz.
Here.
Elizabeth Gatz.
Here.
Dinesh Kumar. Patrick Winsky. Bridget Hayes.
Here.
Michelle Heenan. Ocean Joffrey, or Kizar
Here.
Joffrey, Srikant Karaikal. Okay. Ocean Kareem.
Here.
Anurag
Here.
LaGresa.
Here.
Jesse Lopez. Xander Lynch,
Here.
Salman Matan, it's on Zoom.
Here. Here.
McGraw, Drew Parekh, Bhavin Patel, Boswati Sharma. Seem set.
Here.
Georgia Smits.
Here.
Razvi Thakur.
Yeah.
Vira Aaliyah Matthews. That's 17. Judge. Oh, I got you.
Perfect. Thank you. Up next, do we have any late additions to the agenda? Okay, great. Eric, I don't think we have the February 19th meeting minutes in our packet, so maybe we'll push that to the next meeting for approval. So we'll skip over that in the next meeting. Up next is introducing business of the day. Today we have two very cool presentations. We have one, first up will be actually a presentation from Cornell Library. Elaine Westbrooks will hear about what the library kind of has to offer for graduate students. And then we also have a presentation from the Graduate School Office of Career and Professional Development, focusing on careers beyond academia programming, which I think will be of interest to a lot of us in our constituents and groups, hopefully. And then we do have two resolutions to look at today, not necessarily to vote on, but at least to discuss. One is an additional guidelines amendment by Xander, which we'll get into after the presentations, and then a joint committee with the student, like the undergrad student assembly, on corporate social responsibility. So we will start actually with item number seven, the presentation from the Cornell Library.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Malia. My name is Elaine Westbrooks. I'm the Carl A. Kroc University Librarian, and I've been in my role about a year and a half. But this is my second time at Cornell. I've been here, I came to Cornell in 2000 and stayed for a couple years, left, and then came back 23 years later. So I'm happy to be here. But I wanted to take this time to just give you an idea of the breadth and depth of Cornell University Library. I mean, I'm pretty biased, but I think it's one of the greatest libraries on the planet. And many of you, I'm certain, have benefited from its from our collections. We're able to license hundreds of thousands of databases, millions of ebooks, a collection approaching 9 million volumes. And so it's a very robust collection. And it is a destination for a lot of people, but specifically if you're studying Southeast Asia, if you're studying the French Revolution, if you're studying Iceland, if you're studying the history of science, like our collections are the best in the world. Like you have to be here if you're studying ornithology, if you're studying beekeeping, if you're studying hip hop. We have these collections that are really available nowhere else in the world. Next slide. So one of the things we do is we make sure that everything about Ezra Cornell is in the library. So let me hit the next slide. Everything Ezra Cornell wrote, we have preserved in posterity. And so this is a letter from Ezra Cornell to his wife, Marianne. He was so excited. He went to President Lincoln's inauguration and then he immediately sat down and wrote a letter and talked about how great Lincoln looked. And he really was enamored, as was everyone else, about his beard. Like, this is the first time Abraham Lincoln appeared in public with a beard, and it was like viral. It was in every newspaper in the 1800s. And but this, you can actually see and touch this document in the library. Next slide, please. The other thing that we do is just these amazing collections that we have that I already mentioned. And what's important is, scholarship and research is built on trust and built on former knowledge, right? Not knowledge that's always already been produced. And that's one thing that libraries really do well is we preserve the scholarly record. So everything that's been published, whether it's Cornell Library or Harvard or Michigan, we all work together to make sure that future generations of Cornellians, whether you're a graduate student, professional student, have access to this amazing research. So next slide, please. And so, as I mentioned, a lot of it is e-journals and databases. And today, most of this is electronic. We still have print journals that are available, but right now, this is what's actually taking up the bulk of the library budget. We probably spend somewhere around 12 to 14 million a year just on this. It's very, very, very expensive. Next slide, please. We also invest in our general collections, as I mentioned, Iceland, Southeast Asia. This is an example. We have a tremendous map collection, and this collection is used by historians, but also geographers and comparative literature. I mean, this is a map about suffrage and so women's studies, and so this is just one item in our millions that I just wanted to share, something that is really special and unique that is already digitized, and we have a lot of people who use maps in their research as well as with teaching and learning. Next slide. Another thing we do is we have these specialized services. Other than graduate students, no one else is really checking out a lot of books anymore. We already know that graduate students disproportionately use the library more, use library services more, use collections more. And right now, because you can pretty much find the book on your own, you can find the answer to basic questions on your own, we really switched our services into a more specialized space. So, next slide, please. So one of the big services we promote is evidence synthesis. And this is a whole wraparound service where when you start your research process, we can help you find the data you need. We can help you register your data. We can help you do whatever you need for your research project. And this started out of the medical field of systematic reviews, and we've catered it towards social science and other kinds of sciences, as well as the arts and humanities, to really help you as graduate students, but also professional students, but also faculty and students really use the service a lot. Next slide. The other thing that we do is we say that we deliver literacy, and literacy is not, I mean, obviously you all know how to read, but we really focus on how do you seek, find, analyze, and use information to meet your social, academic, personal goals. And this is really important. When I first became a librarian 25 years ago, You know, I would say we only used about three of these literacies, and now we have 10. And you'll notice AI is on the top left corner, and that is largely because we have to teach algorithms a lot so students understand how their information is constantly being filtered. You don't have access to the entire internet. You have access to a fraction, right? And so what we see is a lot of students come in, they use ChatGPT, and they have these fake citations. And so we use that as an opportunity to teach. This citation looks really good, but it's fake. There's nothing about it real. The journal looks nice. The author actually is studying the same area that you're investigating, but this is not a real citation. And that's a great opportunity for us to teach. How do you find peer review? How do you cite it? And how do you, I mean, I think ChatGPT is great. I use it every day, but you have to use it responsibly. So we teach that quite a bit. And I already mentioned algorithmic literacy is something we teach. Also, we help people teach people on privacy. How can you search and remain private? I don't know how many times you've been searching for a book bag or some shoes, and then every time you get online, you're inundated with book bags and shoes. So we can teach you how to not have that happen if that's not what you want. And the primary resources, of course, in our archives, and you know how to find newspapers and maps and things like that. It's really important that we're able to help you find those materials. Next slide, please. And then discovery, the next slide. We bring in a lot of classes into the library, and this is an example of a public history course. You can't do public history without the archives in the library, so this class met in the library every class. And we were able to provide them access to our collections in order to do the research that they needed to do. By public history, I mean history that is for lay people, you know, not the theoretical history that you might take in a graduate history seminar, but really like something like the 1619 Project or other kinds of projects that are designed to make sure history is accessible to lay people, to the general public, and not for scholars necessarily. Next slide. So one thing I just wanted to bring up is this past year, we've had more books banned in this country than since we've been counting how many books get banned in the past 20 years. I just wanted to bring it to your attention. I mean, this is not something that I have to deal with a lot as a research librarian. I mean, this is happening in school libraries and public libraries. But I just want you to be aware, you all come from communities, and censorship is just wrong, right? Like, it's one thing for you to not like a book, but to keep other people from using a book is just not cool. And I assure you, the Cornell University Library has a lot of books, and you will be offended by many of the books. I could offend all of you, I promise you. And that's the way it's supposed to be, but the reason why they're censoring books is because they are dangerous. And the third most censored book in this country today is by a Cornellian, Toni Morrison. Her Bluest Eye is the third most censored book. And it's, I don't know why they do it, because it just makes people want to read it more. but I just wanted to bring that up, that this is a moment in our history and that our library is really fighting censorship. And we believe deeply in intellectual freedom. And so when you come to the library and check out a book, no one has access to that information. So no one can know what book you read. And we protect that. We protect you from sharing what you read with the government, with your parents, with anybody. Nobody should know what books you read. We deeply believe in that. That's a fundamental tenet and value of libraries and librarianship. Next slide. So we really focus on making our democracy be resilient. So these are the four things we really think about quite a bit. And, you know, we want to be that place where you can verify information, right? And so if you're looking about facts and truth, the library is a place where you can verify, you can cite, you can reproduce information because it's in the library, it's in the archive, it's high quality, right? And so we think it's really important that there's a place for you to verify that the Holocaust did in fact happen. You can verify what Ezra Cornell wrote on any given day of the year. You can verify when a country was founded. You can verify all kinds of information in the library. We all know that a lot of stuff on the internet is just pure trash, right? And then, of course, we do all these other things about, we help you understand what's important to remember. We also focus on truth and the facts. And I already mentioned intellectual freedom is already part of the Library Bill of Rights. We have 7 articles, and they're all dedicated to ensuring that you have all the information you need to do the research that you think is important. Next slide. Okay, so here's some services that I think that I already know that you all are already using quite a bit. So next slide. And most of them are really about how do you get access to our collections or the collections in other libraries. So the first thing is interlibrary loan is used the most by all of you. And so we have a lot of stuff, but we don't have everything. So if you need to get a book from another library in the world, we got you, and we don't charge you for that. Second thing is Borrow Direct. Borrow Direct is interlibrary loan for the Ivies. So if you want a book from Princeton, we also include about 5 other non-Ivies in this whole system. And that includes Duke, Stanford, Chicago, Johns Hopkins. But this whole setup, Borrow Direct, was designed so that you actually interact directly with Princeton, Harvard, and Yale. You don't have to go through us. And so Borrow Direct is typically faster. And so sometimes with interlibrary loan, it could be anywhere from 48 hours to 2 weeks. Borrow Direct, we could usually get your title in about 2 days, is roughly when you go. Document delivery is what we call digitizing print. And so if you want something in a library and you just, you know, you want it digital, we can scan it for you and send it to you. The other thing is you can recommend a purchase. Actually, last year we bought over 4,500 titles just through that link. So if you want us to buy it, I can't guarantee you are going to buy it, but we buy, I think, roughly about 95% of what people ask. Even if it's fiction, it doesn't have to be nonfiction, but let us know, and there's a link on our webpage. You just click it, tell us what you want, and we typically will buy it for you. And then the other thing is, if you don't want to talk to anybody or anything, just come to, you could fill out the form, come to yours, and have any book sent there. And then, of course, we send books from library to library. If you don't want to walk to Olin, you can send it to Mann. If you want to, you're a vet, we can send it to vet or physical scientists. We have 18 libraries, so pick which library you want to go to, and we can make sure that title gets there. Next slide. So I just want to remind you that we don't have fines anymore. So, and that's not to tell you just to take out books and never bring them back, but we stopped doing this a couple years ago, and I just want to remind people. And so we want you to come to the library. If you owe some fines, we will forgive them. The only thing we don't forgive is, like, if you check out cameras or laptops and stuff like we need that stuff back. But if it's a book, we're not going to sweat you over $2. And we're definitely not going to wait till it's time for you to graduate to hold up your diploma because you owe us $3. Like, we don't do that anymore. So just remember that. And we want our stuff back, but we're not going to charge you for shipping it low longer anymore. Next slide. There's another one, isn't this? Okay. So the other services that we know are heavily used by graduate professional students are consultation on all of these different areas. Every department has a librarian. So you're an econ and you need some help and you want to save some time, go to the library webpage, contact the econ librarian. That person will help you do whatever you need to do, and they have training in that discipline. The other thing is, actually, go to the next slide, please. This is a fund that I want you to be aware of. If you are publishing and it's an open access publisher, we can help pay for your article processing charges. My suggestion, though, is do not wait till too late for this. And what we're trying to do is sometimes we run out of money in January or March or, you know, but what I'm planning to do is try to find more money specifically for just graduate professional students. You all just don't have the resources that faculty have, and we want to make this as a fund specifically for you all because we think open access is important, but we also know that there are a lot of mandates. Sometimes you don't have a choice but to publish an open access journal, and you have to pay a $1,000 APC charge, and I know you don't have that money. So that's something we're working on. Next slide. This is every week. If you're working on some data cleanup, you need to figure out a way to where to deposit your data, or you're just having a problem, or you need some help with your scripts, you know, we can help you. And so this is at Mann every week. So we have on the fourth every Thursday, and you can also get donuts too. So please check this out. You can register. You see, it tells you how many seats are left, and you can find this on the website. Next slide. For you humanities students, we have this really good summer digital humanities program, and we offer these fellowships, and I think we just posted it fairly recently, but it's pretty competitive. But if you have any digital humanities project, we will get you from the beginning, from soup to nuts, on how to get this project off the ground. And we often hire some computer scientist folks to help with the programming to make sure that you can do what you need to do. And right now I'm raising money to build this program so that every student who wants to do it actually has the can actually participate. And right now it's pretty constrained. Next slide. This is the copyright I mentioned. If you're trying to create an image, use an image, reproduce an image, there are copyright issues you need to take into consideration. Even what you share with your classes, your teaching classes, you have to be careful. There's a thing called fair use, and you can't just send a link to an article. And you have to be careful about that because I think lots of times we inadvertently violate copyright. So if you have any doubts, email copyright@cornell.edu. It comes to the library. We have librarians who think about this every day, and they can help you make good decisions. Next slide. Oh, there's two more things I wanted to mention. One is, if you're not aware, 501 in Olin Library is a space that's only for graduate students. So your card should be able to get you into that room. And it is quiet and there's space you can spread out. Definitely check it out. 501. As soon as you get off the elevator, you'll see it on your left. The other thing I want to remind you is there's ecommons.cornell.edu. Many of you are publishing and you're being asked to make your article publicly available because you have grant funding. Do not pay that article processing charge. Deposit your article in ecommons and that counts. So if a publisher says, look, you have to give us 2,000 and then we'll make it open for you, you don't have to do that. You can go to ecommons.cornell.edu for free, and we will deposit your article, give you a DOI, and you're done, right? So I just went through a lot of services, and I can go on and on, but I really tried to highlight the ones that I know that you're already using and just to make sure that you're aware. So, Malia, I don't know how I'm on time, but.
Yeah, I think we have a couple minutes for
Okay.
any questions.
Are there any questions? Comments? Right here.
Can you please repeat the last part which you talked about?
The e-commons?
E-commons, yes.
Yeah, e-commons is I should go.
E-commons.
Yeah. For now that you you just have to kind of takes a couple minutes to register, but this is for research articles, but it also includes PowerPoints, white papers, gray literature, things like that. But this is for anybody at Cornell. And again, this is really a repository to help you archive your research. And we'll help you put it in. We also could put data sets in here, but they can't be too big. And we'll work with you on that too. If you have a data set that you need to archive because you got federal funding, we can help you put it in this site as well. Does that cover your question?
Yeah, it does. And suppose if I go for publication of that article, which is there in e-commerce, will that show as a plagiarism?
Plagiarism?
Yes.
No, I mean, this is, we can consider this potentially a preprint if you put it in here, but no, I know a lot of some students. So, for example, we actually have a version of this, which is where your thesis and dissertations go. So that is not the case. Like, as long as you get it in here, it's, once you put it in there, it saves you from being scooped because it's actually public. Well, we call it technically published. A lot of people say, oh, if I put my stuff out there, people are going to scoop it. Well, if you put it out, you're actually less likely to be scooped. And you get your own DOI and a citation for it. So, yeah, it should definitely be public.
What would you say the big difference is between e-commons and something like bioarchive or archive for people who are in those fields? Is there one? Or
that's a great question. The difference is with bioarchive, archive, all those iterations of archive, is that there actually is a whole robust process in the bioarchives where actually I think in some of those cases there is some peer review that's happening. This is not, there's no peer review in here. This is like you put it in there, you forget it, and we're going to take care of it for the next 500 years, right? Archive is a little bit different, and Archive has, I'm trying to think, they have a whole different set of processes, but what we'll do is we will, we are in the business of preserving things forever, or 500 years, and this is free, and we will, we pretty much will archive anything. It doesn't matter what discipline, doesn't matter. I mean, archive is technically free too, but we don't care if you're humanities, physical sciences, medicine, we do everything. Whereas these archives are often subject-based disciplinary repositories. Yes.
Can you speak shortly on services for alumni?
Oh yeah, actually I should find that webpage. But yeah, once you graduate, you will not necessarily have access to everything, but we do have about, I think, 30 or 40 resources that you have access to, such as JSTOR, Duke University Press, Cornell University Press. It's not the same, like you won't get the New England Journal of Medicine, but we still are working towards licensing more for alumni who are not, currently students, faculty, and staff, but you still have access to some materials.
So you mentioned COP fund, right, where aspirant can utilize that fund to publish a paper in open access. Is there a limit, like per year, each individual can publish only one, or is it through, you know, this degree only one?
We don't typically have a limit, but we try to be equitable, so we don't want one person like taking them all up. But it also depends on what kind of journal, right? So if we are not excited about giving people money to publish in, for example, some of the Elsevier journals, like they are, like they're killing us, like they're gouging us. And you still have the option to publish it, but it will be closed behind the paywall, right? We want to provide this for people who, like, you really have no choice. So for example, PLOS, you have to publish open access. You have to, ACM, that's another one. You have to publish in open access. That's your only option. You have to pay a fee. Those are the ones we really prioritize at the top of the list. But if you have any doubts, let us know. I'm trying to increase this fund, and I hope to do that very soon so that we turn away less people.
All right, let's give Elena a round of applause.
And if anybody needs anything from the library, just let me know and I will do what I can to help.
Thank you. All right, up next we have a presentation from the Graduate School Office of Career and Professional Development.
Thank you so much. We really appreciate that invitation to be here. My name is Colleen McLinn, and I'm the Associate Dean for Professional Development in the Graduate School. And joining me this evening is Susie Barbiana, who's the Executive Director for Careers Beyond Academia Programming. And so I'm just going to present a very short slide deck to start, and then hopefully we'll have time for questions, comments, brainstorming ideas. We know there was a lot of interest in hearing this presentation, and so we thank you very much for that. So we know from our national trends, from career outcome surveys that we do, from exciting personal updates that we get for students, that our alumni move on to a variety of different careers. And we're really committed to working with our graduate students and postdocs and helping them really understand their career interests and explore them, demystify the process of understanding, you know, what skills they need for the next thing they'd like to do. Understanding better how to network and find career mentors, and also thinking about how to present yourself to best advantage in written application materials, in interviews, in, you know, conference and job talks. And so we're going to share some resources to that end this evening. The Office of Career and Professional Development is a relatively new structure within the graduate school. So we formed this in fall 2022. And the idea was that we brought together and decided to kind of elevate the role of career and professional development within the graduate school, much like there's an Office of Inclusion and Student Engagement and Graduate Student Life. And so we brought together existing programs, and our overall goal is to serve all PhD and research master students. So this is 5,200 students, as well as postdoctoral scholars, and there's 800 of those as well. And we feel like we're really uniquely poised within the graduate school with knowing how the doctoral student experience looks and what we can do to support the many career interests that our students have. We really partner a lot with other offices and programs. So 2 weeks ago, you heard a Center for Teaching Innovation give a program, and so we partner with them a lot. We also, I'll talk a little bit later about Central Career Services and their programming, and we partner with them a lot as well. And we're really aiming to provide tangible career assistance at scale. And so the programs I'm talking about within the graduate school serve the 5,200 research degree students, research masters, doctoral scholars, as well as postdoctoral scholars. And we have themes emphasizing careers beyond academia, future faculty and academic careers, and then postdoctoral studies as well, which may not be as immediately relevant to you, but the Director of Postdoctoral Studies is a great resource if you're thinking about should I do a postdoc on the pathway to where I'm going, and how does one even find a postdoc or apply for a postdoc? So just to talk a little bit more, actually, before I do that, I wanted to use this as just a great example. So these are three of our now alumni. One of them was a research master's student in social science, one a PhD student in life sciences, and one a PhD student in social sciences, a different social science. And they went into three like completely different career tracks, but are all, I'm in touch with all of them still, and they're all really happy with where they ended up. So the life scientist, for example, went into industry and is doing research. One of the social sciences did an international postdoc and is now back in the US as a tenure track assistant professor. And then another person went into, after doing a master's, went into a research-focused position with a non-governmental agency. And so I just think this is such a nice example of ways that we can bring together students to interact. Here they're doing practice elevator pitches as part of a fall course that I do on theater techniques for enhancing teaching and public speaking. And Miranda took that course. Hey, Miranda.
So these are our core team members, myself and Susie, as well as Christine Holmes, who directs postdoctoral studies, and Sarah Day, who directs who is a professional development program coordinator. And she's been running our 3-minute thesis competition, which I'll talk a little bit more. So overall, kind of the major components of what we're doing, we do skill development programs. So I mentioned a moment ago, courses, and as well as the course on theater techniques for enhancing teaching and public speaking. Susie also offers a graduate practicum each semester, which we'll talk about a little bit more. We also do a number of workshops. Sometimes individual workshops, and I'll mention a few of those, but also we bring together like day-long programs and institutes as well to have kind of a variety of different types of programs. We do a large number of one-on-one consultations and advising. So if you come in to talk about academic job search and would like someone to review your application material, CV, cover letter, research statement, teaching statement, diversity statement, you'll probably meet with Christine or I, and we do hour-long consultations on those. If an hour is not enough to get through all of those documents, we can do follow-ups as well. We also do a lot of just general advising. Some of the more fun meetings that I've had have been early on when people are just like, I just arrived at Cornell and I just want to know like what kind of professional development opportunities there are in general and like what should I do over the course of my like several years here. And so that's a really fun conversation to have as well and strategize with folks. With Susie, the consultations are around careers beyond academia and they might look very different depending on people's interests and needs. So Susie has an intake form to kind of better understand where people are coming in and where they can focus their time effectively in the consultations. And then we also have, you know, experiential and networking opportunities that we'll talk about a little bit more. And then we partner with a lot of offices around campus just to try and make existing resources and things even more relevant and available to graduate students. I mentioned that my emphasis is on future faculty and academic careers. So for example, I'm running a spring series on research mentorship skills. So working with grad students and postdocs who might have summer undergraduate research students. And we'll walk through a number of planning phases and do like practice role play and things like that to think about how will you handle tricky situations if you encounter them in research settings. We also participate through the CERNL network, which is a national network of 45 research universities, and they have a lot of programming around approaching your teaching with a research mindset and thinking about what are my students actually learning and how do I know that. And then I mentioned we also do academic job search consultations, and Christy and I do an academic job search series with sessions on like each of the documents for applying for academic jobs. So now we're going to transition a little bit, and I did want to talk about the wider network. This is kind of a
schematic figure that's coming out of discussions that have been ongoing this year about Cornell's Reimagining Careers at Cornell process. So we are very fortunate that in addition to like the graduate school's career office, a number of the colleges have career offices as well. So if you are in a specialty master's program,
if you're a professional degree student, you might have a more tailored college career office available to you as well. So these are some examples of them. We also partner a lot with Central Career Services, which reports up through student and campus life. And they are really good partners for some of the large scale like services and software that would be of interest to undergraduates and graduate students. For example, Handshake, which is a place where you can find a lot of events as well as job and internship postings. They developed a career development toolkit in Canvas that has a ton of resources and also have memberships and things like InnerStride, where you can find employers that would be interested in hiring international students based on like visa type. And And they're just really good partners in this whole effort. We've been, since their new executive director, Erica Chris, took the role in fall 2022, we've been having just really wonderful brainstorming conversations with them about how to better support graduate student career efforts at Cornell. And both Erica and a number of our other staff have graduate degrees also, so they really are approaching it from a place that they're familiar with what the experience has been like in their career. Okay, so now we're going to transition a little bit to careers beyond academia, which was particular interest to this group and motivator for this presentation. So Susie has been our director for 10 plus years, and this started initially as a National Institutes of Health Broadening Experiences in Scientific Training grant, but it was institutionalized several years ago at the close of the grant within the graduate school. And the overall vision is to really increase awareness of and explore the many options available. We know from our doctoral career outcomes survey data that about half of our students go into academia and about half go into other careers. And then within that other careers, there's a huge variety of possibilities. And so part of the goal there is to really, you know, make it more clear, what are those possibilities? What skills do you have? You know, what could you do with your graduate degree that might be a really good fit for various different industries or positions? And also to gain skills and experience while you're in graduate school so that you don't feel like you're leaving here and then trying to figure out some of the professionalization and trying to really document all of the skills and get quick experience in them, but really experiencing some of these opportunities along the way. And Susie has launched in, I believe, spring 2022, the Grad 9110 practicum course. It's called Professional Career Foundations, and it's a 7-week course where you really think through in depth what career sector you might be interested in and think about, go through steps of planning, researching it, reaching out to someone in the field, and doing informational interviews and preparing for it more specifically. And Susie can talk more about that and some of the wonderful feedback that students have given on it. One point I wanted to make was that in the graduate school, we offer a lot of programming that's just, you know, open access. And we encourage people to share it and sign up for it. But we're also eager to coordinate with fields and grad student groups around programming. We have developed a list of kind of commonly requested workshop topics. And then we're also very happy to help support student-initiated and run efforts with guidance. This can be a really good professional development experience to plan and put together something a little more tailored to your own field of study or your own area. And one of the particular ways in which Susie has done that is through the Create Your Own Activity funding mechanism. And so you can find more about that on the website. A really cool example of something in the works right now, through a partnership with multiple graduate student groups, including the Cornell chapter of the Biomedical Engineering Society and the Chemical and Biomolecular Engineering Women's Group. There's going to be a conference prep series with 3 sessions, including one on developing abstracts, one on posters, and one on developing slide decks. So it's one of the kinds of things we really love to encourage is multiple grad student groups with similar interests working together. It makes it so much more value added to give a workshop and have like a bunch of people from across fields talking to each other and practicing, talking about their research. A couple of upcoming opportunities that I wanted to mention. Just a sampling of some of our core topics that we talk about through our programming. Christine and Susie are going to be giving a Zoom workshop on exploring careers outside academia tomorrow. How's March 12th tomorrow already? Next week, we have the finals of our 3-minute thesis competition.
And this is really exciting. We just went through the video preliminary round. We had a great number of robust submissions, and then a really hard judging task with volunteer judges internal to the university. And then we're going to have some Cornell and Ithaca community judges to score the finalists. And we'll have public in-person final presentation at 3 p.m. in G10 Biotechnology Building on March 20th. It'll be really fun. It's so neat to see people talk about their research in just short form, general interest snippets.
And
there will be a People's Choice Award
as well, so you can help choose who you think gave a wonderful research talk. Also upcoming, we're going to do, Christine and I are doing a Should I Do a Postdoc workshop by Zoom later in March.
And so this will look at,
you know,
what are the different kinds of postdocs and what are the reasons for doing a postdoctoral position
to help you better understand and weigh whether that's an important step for you. And then coming up at the
early summer,
we do a day-long Pathways to Success symposium. And
so we have an alumni keynote lined up for that, which is going to be really exciting. We're bringing an external speaker from out of town to do a leadership visioning workshop.
We're going to have a panel of faculty, and you'll hear more about that soon.
And also opportunities to network and meet
resources and explore some different career pathways within academic administration specifically. And with that,
I wanted to transition to questions,
but also introduce Susie more formally. So Susie has a number of resources to get involved with Careers Beyond Academia.
We mentioned that there is Create Your Own Activity Grant. So this is something that, you know, in contrast to the academic job search, where although there's different types of institutions you might teach at and you know, academic roles might look a little bit different from place to place. You know, there's such a wide variety of things that people could do with non-academic careers that it's a really great opportunity to have a broader conversation about what does that look like.
And Susie's done a lot of work in putting together a library guide as well,
along with library partners, to explore some of the different career pathways and also lists of career
mentors that you can contact to find out more about what it's like to work within that setting. Right. With that, I think
I'll just show our last slide and then I'll back up for a second. But thank you again for
having us.
And we're really interested to hear what questions and ideas you have.
Thanks, Colleen. Do you have any other examples of some of the other create your own
activities
that have been funded?
Yeah, so the sky's the limit there. And on that page, I do give a bunch of different examples. It might be as different as I funded a small group of people to go to Boston for a policy hackathon that was held at MIT Harvard. And while they were there, they also happened to visit and meet with people at NPR because they were interested in public communication of science, and they interviewed folks at Science Friday. So that's, I just funded their travel. They organized everything else, and these people were from different fields. So on the trip over, they rented a fleet vehicle. They got to know each other, and I don't have to debrief with them after the event because they're going to talk about that in the car and then with that. It might be something like a career panel within a field. It might be getting a bus full of people to go down for a march for science in Washington, D.C. It might be bringing in our archaeologist to talk about her user design career and do some hands-on work developing recommendations for a design problem within that section. So it can be really varied, and it's only limited by your imagination.
And is there a cost or a grant size limit on that?
Yeah, so I tend not to give numbers, but in general, if it's the same person coming back, I limit to one a year. And secondly, it's in the order of $1,000. Sometimes they're so good at fundraising for the idea that I spend nothing, and that's fine because then there's more money for somebody else. But I give that promise that I'll support that activity. So for instance, there might be a regional conference that your chapter wants to bring to Cornell, and then you can put it on. So it's in that range. And oftentimes it involves other partners that I can help you identify. And sometimes they ask me to do something. I'd rather empower you guys to be the panel moderators or to invite the panelists directly. Of course, I'll help give good guidance on how to do that so you're not left hanging, but it's just a lot of fun.
And if we wanted to share with like our constituents, or we have a lot of club representatives here, if we wanted to share kind of the opportunities available with you guys, do you have a PDF or a one pager or something that we could get and share out?
We'll share the slide deck, and then actually we're in the process of putting together a really nice like one pager that's kind of by stage, like early, mid, later in your graduate career as well, and what kind of career development, professional development might be of interest.
And for careers beyond academia, I have like a little card. And the website is just gradcareers.cornell.edu, so, which is the same as the email to contact me. So.
All right. Well, thank you guys so much.
Thanks for being with me.
All right. We will now move into the business of the day. Before we go into brief breakout sessions, I thought, Xander, you might want to walk us through your resolution just so we can look at it and talk about it in our breakout groups a little bit.
Great. So this is an amendment similar to what we passed last time, where these field groups specifically are groups that cannot change their own numbers. They are limited by literally what their department is funded by the university. And so in the same way as other groups that are limited by the university's practices, I feel like the field groups should in some way have a different set of rules applied to them. Specifically exempting them from those membership caps that they have no ability to change themselves. If there's comments, I'd love to hear what changes would make this more acceptable, or if there's support, I'd also love to hear about that.
Great. Yeah, I think a couple of things for us to think about as we go into breakout groups will be how exactly we define field groups, because I don't think that the GPSA has like an exact definition. Like there are some groups that can apply for additional field funding, but I don't think we have an exactly written out definition. So maybe thinking about the terminology of what groups, like is this a department specific group that we're referencing, or could it be one that is across multiple departments? Just thinking about that. And then one other thing was right now it says the number of members to maintain or move between the funding tiers. I know that some people have brought up an issue of a very small group being able to move up to the highest tier if we have this exemption and want to be able to spend the money relatively equitably between like student groups that have more or fewer students. So maybe taking out the move between and just keeping the maintain, like we're not going to kick down groups that have fewer, but now that we have this new required number of membership, kind of grandfathering those groups in was just a consideration. We still maybe need to do the math on that for the activity fee that we just set, but that was a consideration to maybe make it more amenable to folks. So, and then the other one, we still need to make some edits on it, but the student assembly made a committee to look at what the university is investing in with their endowment, and they want to have graduate students involved in that as well to kind of make recommendations to Cornell administration on what we as students support or don't support as investments. And we are planning to send graduate students to that. But yes.
So just clear, we're not creating a new committee. We're just resetting our representatives into a pre-existing committee.
Yeah, the SA already passed a resolution to create an ad hoc committee. So I think we'll just be sending a couple of people to it, as I know of currently, just so we don't have multiple committees that then have to communicate. But I would, we'll probably table this motion until then.
And there's one more comment from Resolution 6. So the current definition of field groups would apply to like literally every single group, because any group can apply for field group funding. It also happens to affinity groups. That has a well-defined definition in the AIF email that went out, I believe, last month. So just keep in mind the phrasing and terminology.
Okay, great. Sanders, you have one more.
I forget which point it is, which is bad because I'm on that committee. But I did have a question about that. Wasn't that definition of affinity group like codified in that email? Like, if we can make these definitions up as we go, then we can also make one up for what a field group is.
Yeah, can be done. Just would have to be a more, I guess, formalized process than like in the next 30 minutes.
Yeah.
Alternatively, if an amendment within Resolution 6 were to be passed that includes a definition of what we define field group as, wouldn't that also make this puzzle amendment more feasible?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, so that's just a consideration for how we would define it in here.
Okay,
so we will break up into groups by field for, I don't know, let's say 7 minutes just to discuss Resolution 6, any ideas or comments on that. And then we will meet back at 6:10 to discuss. So let's do life sciences, physical sciences, professional, humanities, social sciences.
Too much, but also make it. that one of the
arguments. But there's also silver on the left, which is like additional funding.
It's only going to be for 12 places or whatever. So,
Well, here's my thing when it comes to
because the previous people
following the whole membership requirement of the because it's not just about like how many people we tier towards, it's more so about
when I was
running how much of an impact they make on campus and stuff. And that's also very much dependent on money and
revenue.
Their orientation to kind of a small budget for a long time and stuff. Their goal is not necessarily to expand well to the club so they can reach out to people that talk to their groups, they want to focus on making the most of whatever budget they have and that will lead to a small scale event, some good shows.
Yeah, I think that would be another thing if this got out of the
party. And then that's also. There and the other budget allowed for a small kind of rides on the train.
It's already
on the So, by allowing for there to be an assault of membership, that can allow for the smart comes to the children. The whole point of all this is to represent the threat of students. And they're very clear about the end of the
I think the thing is like
there are other resources.
I feel like we want to tell them that they want to where it feels like a small idea rather than any person in a small water club that has organizational know-how and make it thrive.
the whole world better, be careful. But I highly doubt that there are any events that are happening that are shared broadly to diversity outside of the club. That's just the consequence of our social our social outreach and our nets. Theoretically, my life events or GGD has it as part of
the group. Unless an objection,
feel free to come by.
One person gives it or
unless somebody a wit. What's the reality and what's the best outcome?
Is that actually going to happen?
Realistically, we're not really affecting the campus all that much. So, I mean, and I also think it's pretty hard to quantify like a club's outreach.
But I think that's almost kind of for like designated.
This activity
The next super title section.
I'm in horticulture. We do apple sales once a year. So if some organization or customer,
it just goes back into the big pot that we have. So that's goes back into our reserve fund.
Can I actually get steal the agenda?
Just give it back to me.
But we have to plan for it.
Using this time, the plot and things.
They don't usually, but they like, so they have to do it.
Oh, and then just taking the front.
I believe that the
using application to it becomes a pretty big issue. I know that that's not an always seems to that's just a learner most out of the government is that prior that you want it to be. When we know how much time it
already thank you. An amount of your proportional
my field is
everybody, let's start wrapping up.
I guess if you're in a biochemistry, you go to the consuming
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, that's yours.
All right, so we will move into discussion on resolution 6. I would favor amendments to limit discussion to like 10 minutes, just so we can still get out of here on time, if anyone would like to make that motion.
I'm sorry, can you read this?
I would entertain a motion to limit discussion on this to around 10 minutes, just so we can still get out of here. When, is that a motion for unanimous consent?
So moved.
Do we have a second for that?
Yes, second.
Does anyone disagree with that? Okay, so we will have conversation until 6:25. Yes.
I'd like to motion an amendment on the current bill, Resolution 6, adding the clause, quote, be it therefore resolved that designated field groups be defined as organizations eligible for field funding per GPS ASC funding guidelines, Section 4, student organization funding allocation, subsection C1.
I'd like to second that as well, and the writing of that can be sent.
And I'll take it as a friendly to my mother.
Okay, great. Would you like to do that by unanimous consent or as...
Unless there's an objection, it's taken as friendly and it becomes a part of it.
Okay, fantastic. Thank you for that. Are there any...
Do we need to clarify what the amendment is for?
Yes, yeah. That would be great.
Yeah, so the amendment basically... So I guess this is my presentation time for Robert. So what the amendment does is it actually ensures self-consistency by referencing GPSA's current funding guidelines to define the term field funded as being the one field organization that can be defunded by their respective department, which is already laid out in our kind of guiding documents. And so it would be self-consistent and kind of cut down on nebulous terminology by
writing. So would that also limit, so I know that there are groups that are five different plant-related groups all are in the School of Integrated Plant Science. There might be a group for them, but also a group for each of the departments. It's just a single department, not like a super group.
It's a single department.
Okay.
Per current document, but I refer to them.
I have a question about this. I'm not sure if that definition is really what was intended in the resolution.
In this resolution.
Yeah. And I don't know because I don't have that definition of the field group. So that might be something to look at before adding just whether that actually matches what is intended in the resolution.
Referring to Representative Lynch, just a quick question. Seeing that you consider this amendment as friendly to it, does that mean that you agree that the definition that's being brought up with the that's this is definition match with what is your intent of this amendment as the author of the amendment.
It matches with my intent, and also I can read out the what is in GPSA's funding guidelines right now if we would like as clarification. But
if it's just a one group from a department.
Okay.
If that's
yeah.
Okay, great. I would like to hear some discussion or entertain a motion on if we like the maintain or move between tiers, or if there's consideration of removing the move between and just keep the maintain current tier.
I'll be pro. I think that moving between the tiers is an important part of this, because if for some reason, 1 year, a group that has been grandfathered in, all of a sudden, the community in that group just dies, but then the next year or in later years, people want to restart, and this was a crucial element of funding that community, then now if they've already been demoted because that community died, that institutional knowledge left, whatever aspect it was, then they're at the basic level. Like, so all it takes is one class of graduate students where everybody has done has done like 3 extra years. There's no more, it's only old graduate students, and then the young graduate students don't have the support, and then that club has died. So.
Any other comments on that resolution? Yes, question.
I'm also standing in the pro of this resolution. Mainly because the way I see it, field groups, like there's many different factors that come into play when determining a club's budget overall, especially when it comes to field groups. It's the membership aspect of it that disproportionately impacts their ability to climb up the tier levels in comparison to the other aspects for other kinds of factors and stuff, and to make it so that it is a bit more equitable when we distribute funds for organizations so they are able to climb up the tier rankings as what most, if not all, clubs within GPSA would want to do. I think it would be more fair for there to be an opportunity for them to climb up tier rankings, because there is that limiting factor that you must have at least a certain amount of members in order to be able to climb up in the first place.
If I may make a comment, I suppose if I was to vote on this, which I can't, so I'm only saying what I hope, is that if I was to make any change, it would be to limit the amount of mobility, at least in the upward direction, to a tier above the membership threshold. I'm inherently concerned with the potential of having a small group receive a overwhelmingly disproportionate amount of funding, regardless of the theoretical good that any one group can do, just to be as equitable as possible, due in fact to the fact that we have a limited income, or at least pool of money to spread. And again, we saw some of the stats the last time. I'm not sure necessarily how much of the funding this would be impacted by, but any less would be worthwhile.
Yes. I guess for me, the question would be, how do we determine the criteria for applying for a tier boost? Because I remember at one point it used to be that you utilize 90% or more of the funds from the previous year in order to be eligible. But then the clause was added that you also need to have a minimum number of members. So I was just wondering, how would it work if we were to consider either of the possibilities?
This would just be removing the membership requirement. Mm-hmm. You still have to spend a certain amount of your budget in order to be considered to the five tier.
Right, so that's what I was concerned about, that if a field organization does utilize 90% or more of the resources in that current academic year, and yet they are unable to, exactly, if they do it and still cannot apply for a tier boost, would that what this entail?
Yes, that's what this would be for, is right now there's a membership limit,
mm-hmm.
but this is to get rid of that membership limit. They still have to spend the budget.
Right.
And so this is considering, do we get rid of the membership limit, or do we put a tier limit, like they can only go one above?
Right.
Is, I think, something worth considering.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Great information. So Xander, with this is not preventing field groups from moving down. So let's just, mm-hmm. okay.
I mean, I see that you would need to be able to move a group down if they're not meeting these criteria. I just don't think that these groups that have historically had this money and have used it every year in GPSA's history should be the cuts that were made for brand new organizations who we don't know if they are going to do anything at all with the money. Maybe they're going to throw one party with $500 worth of snacks, and versus bring in a speaker who adds to the academic atmosphere of Cornell. And I think that's what field groups are in a special position to do, is to add not only those social elements, but also the academic part, because they are focused as a field or as a department.
All right, we've reached the end of debate time. I would entertain a motion to table this, incorporate the new amendment, and continue discussion at our next meeting in 2 weeks.
Can we not vote on the amendments right now and then move to the discussion? Is there governing documents that would be violated if we were to do that procedure?
I think I would prefer to have it fully written up in resolution form. But.
I move the table to the next following version. Yes, I.
Do we have
a second?
Great. Is anyone opposed to tabling this motion? Okay. We will get it written up with the new amendment and continue discussion on it. Okay. We will quickly move to reports of officers and committee updates.
Resolution 7.
We have to make edits on it. So I just was showing it to you guys in its current form, but.
Point of information.
Yeah.
Is the sponsor here? No.
I don't think Gus is here. No. Yeah. All right. Okay. Executive committee. Michelle is not here, but elections will be coming up soon, so consider if you want to run for a committee or executive position. Operations, Annika is not here. Appropriations, I don't think David is here. Communications.
Communicate went out. Yay. We had a lot of really cool activities that are coming up, so make sure to check it. It's, we have like sex trivia tomorrow. So again, if you guys are and want anything to communicate, just send it to me and I'm happy to put it in there.
Great. Finance?
Nope. All's good. Responding to people's emails, giving them money.
Great. Student advocacy.
Here. No updates, but I'm working with Michelle on the transportation thing that she's writing.
Great. DISC.
We have a couple of updates. We had a very constructive discussion with Office of Teaching and Learning today regarding tax filing for international students, and Office of Global Learning has really been on board with the discussion, so they are going to get internally strategized and get back regarding coming up with a document or something that can be widely circulated, and then they are also very excited to collaborate for like further more events on like onboarding of grad students and like orientation. So I think it's a collaboration that can, you know, work successfully. Secondly, it's also mentioned in the newsletter that we DISC has started an initiative called We Are Here For You. So it's basically a Google form where anybody on campus can scan it and let us know any issues, any concerns that you have. And then it can become like a good database for them to kind of reach out and then build a larger conversation on the campus. The link is also in the newsletter, so feel free to circulate it to the people you know. Also, we have our first public meeting on March 19th from 5:45 to 6:45. The Zoom link is also in the newsletter. We also be using other communication platforms like Instagram, LinkedIn, all of those to circulate the link as well. And again, DISC is also funding another diversity and national event. We previously funded the Renaissance Ball, the Raffle at International TGIF, and the Diwali event. So this fourth event, which is organized by Women in Public Policy, which is also happening on March 21st, is going to be our last event that we are funding for this semester. And yeah, feel free to come interact at the event. We'll also be having a table of DISC there to kind of, you know, reach out to more people.
Great, thank you. Programming, Katie isn't here, but tickets for the gala start going out next week. It's on April 27th. So put that on your calendar and let people know that tickets will be coming out soon. We'll send out another email when they're actually coming out. graduate school. I don't think Dean Bohr is here, so we'll skip over that. Open forum. Anyone else have anything they'd like to say? Yes, Ocean.
I just wanted to promote up there. I'm part of the Graduate Students in Public Health, and we're collaborating with a bunch of organizations, including Toronto Progressives, LGBT Resource Center, and Toronto Democrats to host a sex ed trivia night tomorrow from 5 to 7 p.m. in Willow Street Hall. We're giving away tons of condoms and Plan B pills for free, along with having trivia nights that you can just like answer questions, earn raffle tickets, and you can use those tickets to win a bunch of variety of different prizes, including some actual adult sex toys, but also a Mickey Mouse pillow pet plushie. So if you're interested in any of that, come on right over to Willow Street Hall, bring your friends as well, and have a time.
All right, I would entertain a motion to adjourn.
So moved.
All right, we have a second.
Second.
Fantastic. Thanks, guys. See you in 2 weeks, and hopefully we can vote on Resolution 6.